Hi, Radicals, and thanks for tuning in. This is Sam here from the Radical Writing Podcast. Some of these texts stretch content as experimentally as they do form, and this is a heads up that some episodes feature discussions of a particularly sensitive nature. For example, we may be reading and then elaborating on extracts which feature swearing, violence, and sexual content. And discussions will be compassionate and empathetic, but also, in order to accurately reflect the text, explicit. Engaging with these challenging topics is often key to the author's technique and central to the story they're telling. But they can be difficult subjects to discuss and listen to. Listen for the trigger warnings at the start of the episode, and if you prefer to avoid that episode, do check out another one from the series. And if you think that the series as a whole may not be suitable for you, that's okay too. If you are comfortable listening on, now is the time to pop your headphones on or to find a private space. Hello, Radicals, and welcome to the weird and wonderful literary world of the Radical Writing Podcast, the series dedicated to the best in contemporary experimental or innovative writing. This is episode 4, Tom Phillips, A Humorment. My name is Sam Kemp, and I'll be your host. I'm a poet and lecturer in creative writing. Today, my guests are Chloe Pinto and Izzy Snowden, and we've all chosen a favourite section of the book and prepared some questions for the group. Just a trigger warning before we go any further, this text and our discussions may involve some sexual content, swearing, and anti-Semitism. A Humorment by Tom Phillips is a famous and popular artistic treatment of the W.H. Malick's 1892 novel, The Human Document. Phillips' appropriation or misappropriation of the original text consists of a beautiful and colourful painting and sketching over the original page, obscuring all but a handful of text and rearranging the words into a poetic new narrative. The resulting plot, strung over the 367 pages of Malick's original text, follows a Bill Toge and his romantic endeavours and encounters, often cast adrift, literary and figuratively, in a textual landscape which is both contemporary and Victorian. It's a text of revision, reworking and hijacking, both speaking to, from and against the original source. A Humorment was first published in book form in 1973, and has gone through numerous wildly varied editions and was a lifelong project for its artist. Okay, Izzy, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Izzy Snowden and I'm a third year history and creative writing student. I've recently been working as a research assistant on the Mapping the West End project and the Wapping Dispute project. I'm also the editor-in-chief of the student newspaper The Waterfront.
Brilliant. Thank you, Izzy. And Chloe, really, really pleased to have you on board as well, particularly because you have some experience with the artist himself.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much, Sam, for having me. My name is Chloe Pinto, and I'm an assistant lecturer here at Northeastern. I teach on the Cultures of London and British Drama and the London Stage courses. So I feel so lucky to have known Tom Phillips for a brief moment. I've been a fan of his work for the longest time. As a child, I would go to the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy and I would sprint to Tom Phillips's pages, so much so that my family would say that if they lost me, they would meet me with Tom. And so when I started my graduate work at Oxford, I discovered that they had recently acquired Tom's archive. And so I just knew that I had to work on the archive, but I had no idea what would be awaiting me and what sorts of treasures were inside. So I thought that I would just conduct a relatively straightforward genetic critique of some of the drafts for Dante's Inferno. But I discovered as I moved through the archive that Tom had left little notes for the reader. So at different moments, he would leave, for example, a tiny note in the margins saying, turn to page 30. And then I would turn to page 30 and there would be a chocolate waiting, so that the archivist would have a little snack and not have low blood sugar while working. And the archive was just full of these tiny little treats in every sense. And it really led me into a labyrinth of thinking about the role of the author in the text and authorial intention as well. Is Tom Phillips the author, the one on the printed drafts, or is he the one speaking to me in this kind of strange way from beyond the margins of the page? So I ended up meeting with Tom at his studio in Peckham and interviewing him for about 4 hours. And it was just so magical. His personality shone through. He was so cheeky and he would just deny ever doing anything. And I had my phone on the table recording the interaction and he would make a statement and just wink at the phone. He would be like, anyone who writes a book about a book is foolish. Wink. I'm like, didn't you do that your whole career? And another thing that kind of shone through for me was his tremendous appreciation and love of poetry, particularly Eliot, Pound, and his sensitivity towards verse and the lyric. And he at one point grabbed my phone and tried to record a message to Christopher Ricks, the literary critic, who was a professor of mine. And so he was obsessed with these connections through verse and poetry. And so it was a really wonderful experience. We kept in touch after that. He would often send me emails telling me what he'd had for lunch. And I'm always grateful for that connection.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Chloe. And Izzy, Chloe, thank you so much, both of you, for coming. When I first started thinking about the Radical Writing podcast series, this was one of the first books that came into my head. It's been a favourite of mine for a few years now. And by far, I think it's the most cheerful and visually striking book in the series as well. And I keep kind of coming back to it. So thanks, Chloe. I think let's kind of, I'd love to pick up on a few of those things. And you kind of mentioned poetry there. And this is kind of a hard book to pin down in the first place. Is it poetry? Is it a novel? Is it something kind of visual in between? I'm going to be really mean and not actually let you answer that question, because I'm going to leap in with my favorite section to begin with. And then we'll talk a little bit about that. So I'm going to read from the fifth edition. And this is on page 48. So for anyone that hasn't come across Tom Phillips, Humant, highly recommend you look it up online now. You'll find numerous images as well as on tomphillips.co.uk. You may be able to navigate to page 48 in the fifth edition as well, and you begin to kind of see what exactly we're talking about. So this is a page which is really beautifully decorated with some colours and some sketches. And this is a page of the original novel, W.H. Malick's Human Document, except that most of the words are obscured by the artwork. There's only certain words which are shining through because they've got these lovely kind of uneven speech bubbles around them. So it's a sort of form of erasure, the actual words that are here. You know, this is maybe 20 words or so that has come out of a whole page. And it is poetry. So this is page 48. In silent colour, this most rose of roses lives. Closely connect, toge and the romance of romance. Here comes the past at last. I'm going to read it again because it's so short. In silent colour this, most rose of roses lives. Closely connect, toge and the romance of romance. Here comes the past at last. So yeah, it was hard to kind of pick a favourite page, and I'm not sure if this is my absolute favourite, but I liked it for a few reasons. I think I like this idea of looking back. There is a kind of nostalgia here. There is a kind of sincere act of unearthing the past. Here comes the past at last. And it kind of calls into question and fact the materiality of the book, the original novel, 1892, this one being republished and republished and reprinted and made new every single time. So I think, as you were kind of saying, Chloe, there's this hint of, well, which is the original, which is Tom Phillips, and which is W.H. Malick when we come here. But yeah, here comes the past at last, I really, really like. And also Toad and the romance of romance, because this is a romance story. This is a kind of love story that is spun throughout. So yeah, 367 pages, but there is a plot and there are characters and a bit of a narrative as well. What do you think? What strikes you with that particular section?
I'm so glad that you chose this page. I think this is such a brilliant way for us to open up our discussion, because the initial thing that struck me when glancing at this page are the literary allusions. So for example, this reference to the rose over and over again, the repetition. I'm hearing echoes of Gertrude Stein in there.
Yes, and Eliot.
Of course.
In the Rose Garden.
Yeah. Absolutely. Even Shakespeare's sonnets as well. So this question of an enduring symbol of romance, of connection, what does it mean, not only for the past to come at last, but for the past to last as well? Yeah. What is enduring and almost universal about the individual experience? Because we have Toge, our protagonist, whose name is spliced from either the words altogether or together.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that atomization and individualization of the term for connectivity as well. So finding those moments of individuality inside the grand scheme of history, I think, is something that this page is really speaking to and about. So
that's beautiful. I like that. This kind of this making human of the grand narrative. In a way, a human document, of course. And I keep going back to this idea of the chocolate in the archive.
Yeah.
I think that's such a beautiful kind of idea. We may have found the title of the episode right there.
Chocolate in the archive.
Yeah, something human, something kind of jokey
in the
life and death of the seriousness of it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Izzy, what about you?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's such a beautiful, beautiful page. And I think also what strikes me about this page is I really like the here comes the past at last.
Mm.
And I think on each page, there's so many different kind of themes and motifs that you can really go down that just stretch the entire book. And for me, I guess also coming from kind of the history perspective, the past and kind of reckoning the past and the future kind of really came across for me in the book, and just kind of this real connection between or collaboration between Malick and Phillips. Mm. Just the reworking of it. And I mean, also one of my favourite bits is the last page where he literally talks about, I think it's, you know, their bones buried together on something. And the last image is Malick's grave. And it's sort of, I really enjoy the, you know, the past comes at last. I think it's really clear throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
That was going to be one of my pages to talk about as well.
Yeah, it's so, so beautiful. And I just think it ends it so well and just encapsulates the whole thing, really.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah. So it kind of, it also, I kind of got from the whole book this kind of sense of collaboration, like Malick and Phillips collaborating together. Your grave and mine fused. It's the last page on mine. I've got the final edition. It's page 367. But I also kind of got like a collaboration between the reader and Phillips as well. Like there's a few pages where you can see the revisions that he's made. There's a couple where some of the rivers of words, they're sort of scribbled out, but you can still make out the words.
Mm.
And for me, when I was reading, I sort of took it as a, well, you can read it, you can leave it, you can take what you want from it. And there was also so much talk about sort of interpretation of art that I felt as reading it that you were also a collaborator and discovering the different things in it. The way you can read the rivers in different orders and things, it's still up to you. It's not, doesn't have to be as Phillips wrote it.
It's almost like you're witnessing the artist talking to himself as well.
Yeah.
So I should sort of say, I have tried to be extra radical in this particular episode. I've been very, very strict with the other ones and made sure that everyone has the same edition. Well, this one I've tried to do the opposite. So I have the fifth edition and Izzy and Chloe have the final edition. So that final page actually is different for me, which might be kind of fun to dig into. But yeah, I love this idea of the collaboration and you as a reader as well, invited into that kind of collaboration.
I love some of the terms that we've been using to describe this work and Phillips's role in it. For example, like collaboration hijacking as well.
Yes.
When I met Tom, I kind of told him that the notes that he left in the archive made me feel like a detective. And he said that he would be happy to play the next James Bond. So I think he would be really pleased that this sort of relationship was being extracted and enacted through the act of reading and even through the act of conversation as well.
It's a fun one as well. It's just sort of simply fun. I mean, there's a lot of other deeper themes and more serious themes that we're going to dig into, but I do think that it's something that I just find highly cheerful is this book. Yeah, for the most part anyway. I tell you what, do you want to read that final page again and then we'll see how this final edition and the fifth one compare?
Can I make a small request? Could we add page 366 into that as well?
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Oh, ah, I will, yes. And I said, yes, yes. End. Think of the system's mute. Think of the dark rainbow toge. Dedication. To the sole and only begetter of this volume, by whose bones my bones my best perpetuate, your grave in mine fused, page for page.
Oh, lovely. Wow.
Love that.
Page for page. Again, we've got that kind of life and death being brought up.
Yeah,
and the feeling that we are talking to not only the author, but I think, Chloe, you kind of hinted at this, this kind of more universal life and death, this universal body for body or page for page. It's you know, I say it's a cheerful text, but it's also one that is about life, death and mortality and love. So the final words for me are a little bit different. This is kind of interesting. I've got that same 366, and the top of 367 is the same, but in the fifth edition, we've got Dedication to the Soul and Only Begetto of this volume, by whose side I shall lie, bones, my best perpetuate, equal page for page.
Oh, wow.
He's talking to himself, it feels, and there is some kind of fun there. So I should also say that each of these editions are usually wildly different artwork, different poetry that is coming out of it, and this is a lifelong project for the artist. Chloe, do you want to go ahead with your favorite section, or have we stolen it?
I had about 10 different pages I thought we could look at, but I might just stay with 366 and 367 for a brief moment. I think this is such a brilliant ending to the work, and I think so. The love story between Toj and Irma, his great love, the opera singer, has different endings according to different editions. And so I think in the first edition, Toj and Irma split up and are not reconciled. And then it becomes increasingly ambiguous as the editions change. And so I think this is one of the most hopeful endings for their relationship. And it, of course, speaks to Molly's final words in Ulysses as well. And so this idea of repetition, echoing, voice, stream of consciousness are all encapsulated in this brief moment. And I also think the artwork for 366 is so striking, this idea of a mosaic of these different fragments stitched together to create coherence and texture as well, this question of materiality. We're acutely aware of the two-dimensional page, and yet there's something that speaks beyond that page not just in a kind of material sense, in the sense that we have words which are breaking through the boundaries of the margins, but also in a conceptual sense. We have voices speaking to us from beyond the grave about where they lie. So that was one reason why I just find this ending so powerful and poignant. And the difference in being fused in a grave and lying side by side with someone is so interesting, that distinction. And it speaks to a difference in relationship, I think. Standing side by side with someone suggests individuality, autonomy, juxtaposition, and yet being fused in a grave, almost that kind of dual imprint, much like the pages. So there's a couple of reasons why I just love this.
That fragmentation and mosaic. It's exactly what the text is. It is this mosaic. And a fragmentation through time as well. Mm-hmm. We've got these kind of Victorian phrases that come out. And 1897, so the original novel was Victorian and was written in quite a highfalutin style. And that is still kind of coming through. And so, it feels like, this universal sort of statement that's being made. And maybe it is that there's not much difference between people throughout time as well, and the things that they want and the things that they don't want. I mean, that's a little bit of a leap from what we have going on here, but there's something about a human in general which just speaks to that.
It also speaks to the power of individual words as well. So to return to 367, the line, think of the systems mute, think of the dark rainbow, my mind is immediately traveling to Gravity's Rainbow by Pynchon, and this idea of like systems and the way in which words can change meaning over time. And if this is a type of image that has been excavated from Malick's text, and yet we have this journey through meaning, then that's a statement as well about the enduring and fluid power of language as well as this eternal entity and powerful force. Mm. And so there are different types of meanings that can only be ascertained as we move forward in time, which is, again, another kind of hopeful position on this question of mortality and the fleeting nature of life. There's something long-lasting yet eternally transformative about language.
Enduring and fluid, I think, is a really lovely way of putting it, yeah.
I also found that really interesting because there were words that cropped up that he found that just, you know, Malick would never have known that we would interpret them in the same way. Like he mentions apps, CERN, text, and obviously we just take them in a completely different way. And then I saw this interview on YouTube from 2017, when I think he was opening an exhibition, and the interviewer asked him about a bit on page 54 that said, "Modernize England, structure the rain, un-Europe me."
And,
and he then
2017.
Yeah, and he then said, "Well, I wrote that years ago and I would never write that now."
Oh, wow.
And I just found it so interesting that, you know, obviously Malick's words and meaning have changed for us, but even so recent as Philip's words can now already be taken in a completely different context. And I just found it so interesting the way that words can change so quickly and you can just completely take different things from them. I think he said at the time he was talking about English art and things.
Yeah.
I find it so interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
What an unstable world we live in, where everything can change so much between editions of an artistic book.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're kind of coming into one of my first questions, actually, which is a bit of a tricky one. And I've used both these terms in the introduction, and I don't think there's a solid answer for this, but is this an appropriation or a misappropriation? We've talked about collaboration, and we've talked about, or the essay at the end of the edition, talks about how W.H. Malick would not approve of what is going on here. He's put a lot of time and effort into writing his novel, and he would not approve as to what it would become.
Mm.
What do you think? Is this appropriation, misappropriation? Where is the line between? I ask this because I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things I as well noticed, you mentioned at the start, the anti-Semitism. I really liked that Phillips was sort of able to highlight things like the Holocaust, and obviously because Malick's book was slightly anti-Semitic, but he managed to find the history of it and pull it out and present it. And again, maybe coming from a history background, I really liked that, and I thought there was something nice about taking something harmful and making something beautiful out of it. Mm. I don't know where that kind of stands on, or Malick wouldn't like it, but Malick had problematic views, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I personally appreciated that Phillips did that. I think it was nice to turn it into something beautiful.
Do you have the page for that? Izzy has this amazing amount of notes in front of her.
Too many. So there's one where there's a gold star of David with grey stripes on the background, which is on my page 87. Yeah, so it says, "Ask and ask, no longer to sing the lament of the Jews. Wear a used star, for the day had been killed. The theatre never again."
Mm.
I think it's really poignant.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it's just beautiful to highlight that, yeah.
I think that's a wonderful answer to misappropriation and appropriation, because we can see, okay, maybe it is misappropriation, but it's being done so to gain a greater truth.
Yeah.
Of these historical, some anti-Semitism in 1897, leading up to the Holocaust.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. I'm so glad you brought up this page and the idea of anti-Semitism, because I think that Phillips' work in this not only makes a statement about the nature of Malick's anti-Semitism, but also of anti-Semitism in general.
Mm.
The idea of its relationship to language and literature, but also about how it transforms over time and how it informs and infects different words. And so it's not that we can erase the anti-Semitism, because to do so would possibly be more of a misappropriation or more of an assault to these difficult elements of the work. But instead, Phillips actually foregrounds it and makes us confront it and draws our eye and our attention to it. And reworks it into something, I keep saying the word hopeful, but I think it is relevant here, this idea of hope and this idea of taking the raw stuff of anti-Semitism, the syllables of anti-Semitism, and reconfiguring it into something else that can be considered more beautiful, while also paying attention to that legacy of loss, the theatre never again, for example. So this idea of making new words and constructing new narratives from the fragments of history. Absolutely.
Chloe, do you want to come in with one of your questions at this point?
Yeah, my question. I'm going to try and be a little bit controversial, so I'm going to give you two options.
Ooh.
Should the pages of this book be kept in either an art gallery or a library?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I love visual poetry, and I do a lot of visual poetry, and I think that the key tension, this is a very, very simple one, of where do the words go? Is this a lyric poem? Do we use rhyme? Do we use rhythm? Or are we foregrounding the visuals here? And I think the best visual poetry do both in some way. And I think it's a very, very difficult thing to do. So I am going to be definitive and I'm going to say a book. But saying that, I also think there's a huge scope for seeing this on the walls as well. But I think for me, the act of turning the page and seeing a new poem and seeing the pages maybe separate and the writing and the plot that does develop throughout lends itself to a book for me.
I actually had a really similar question that I was going to ask. So,
we're on the same wavelength
today. I know, I'm loving that. I think I'd agree with Sam, and I don't know if that's just because I'm a bit dense when it comes to artwork and things, and I just think the words are leading and informing the images. I do think there's some images that, occasionally perhaps overshadow the words or convey the sense of the words better. But I think overall for me, we're following the words, and therefore it's first and foremost of a book and a library.
Yeah. I don't know. My instinct is to disagree.
Go for it.
Maybe just because that was how I first discovered the work. And I think this idea of isolating extracts or pages and presenting them with no context almost democratizes the text and the medium and invites in such a wide audience that may never stumble upon this book in a bookshop or a library as Tom Phillips stumbled upon Malick's text. But it's much easier to stumble upon something if it's staring at you. And so maybe that's why I would suggest some of these pages belong in an art gallery. But I'd also suggest that they also belong in an archive with chocolate. So I don't know if you could trust my opinion.
I think we definitely can. I have a question. I think it's a really inspiring text. I think it's a really inspiring example of hijacking. I think, like you said, the misappropriation or appropriation has so much meaning to it. So it's kind of that lovely example of content and form that we always talk about in creative writing. If you could pick up any book and turn it into something else, what would the book be and what would you try and turn it into?
That's such a good question.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to be thinking about this for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
You can always head to the local bookshop and see if you wanted to give it a go.
I think it's a great question because it speaks to maybe the core of this work itself, which is what should change and what should stay. And I guess I'm just free associating, but if I were to change something, I'd want to change something ugly and dangerous and make it into something beautiful and meaningful and rewarding. And as someone who's written on literature of fascism and anti-Semitism, spending a lot of time with horrible, ugly work is a difficult process because there do become moments where the complexity and the thought that goes into this type of work is so apparent that it's undeniable. And so it's not enough to just dismiss things we don't like or dismiss things that are dangerous or toxic. We have to really engage with them. So I would probably pick something that has caused catastrophic consequences throughout history and try and create something beautiful out of it. I'm not sure what that would be or what that would look like, but that would be where I would start.
I guess a question for that might be, would you try and find order or disorder in the work? I mean, this one, I don't know where Tom Phillips lies. There is order and disorder in what he's done to Malick's text, but it's more disordered than the original. I wonder if a text such as the ones you're mentioning, I it would be an interesting one.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Series two. Izzy, what about you?
To start with, I was thinking about, I think Phillips said, it might have been in the notes in the back, that he sort of felt like he couldn't have done it with a different book because the wealth of words in Malick's book really helped. So I was sort of thinking, you know, need something with kind of that wealth of words. But then I just really like what you've said, Chloe, and actually, something that takes something ugly but confronts it instead of hiding it away and turns it into something beautiful, actually, I think is more powerful than just sort of taking already beautiful words and making, you know, trying to build on that and actually try and fix something that might have been a bit scarring, I think would be better. Yeah.
Thank you. I guess there's also something about wanting to work on or with or through something that is very popular, because when Phillips found Malick's book, it was already the ninth printing. So this was a work that was in wide circulation. People were familiar with it. And so there's something about taking that familiar and defamiliarizing it, constructing something out of its skeleton as well. So maybe even taking something in popular culture that has been destructive. I'm sure we can think of many examples on, at a different time.
Oh, I'm sure we can. We may not be able to say them on air. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll be sued.
Yeah. Chloe, do you have any other questions you want to come in on?
Not at this point. I think we've covered them. Yeah.
I was going to say, I've brought up all of mine, like accidentally, not in the form of questions. I had some sort of very vague ones, just bits in the text that I just wasn't sure what to make of.
We've got a little bit of time. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So in my edition, like on a couple pages, there's just sort of random just letters highlighted. So there'll just be like an S or an R at the bottom that kind of seems disconnected. And I wasn't sure what to make of them.
I was hoping anyone... Chloe might know. I was
so
hoping...
was I.
Do you have a page that we might look at?
I might. Let's go page 135 on mine.
There's also a fair few nonsense pages, right?
Where that was another question.
Totally made
up
words.
For me,
language.
It was kind of like a made up Latin or something.
Yeah.
So page 135. Just sort of an S and an R uncovered at the bottom. And I was like, is it the sounds? Is it a red herring? I don't know.
Should we read the whole page?
Let's try it.
Shall I do it?
Take it away, yeah.
Understand verse necessity. Merely live the poetry. Merely connect. Butterfly triumph. Poetry, let me go on. Poets define value. SR.
Yeah, so like a small part of me was kind of thinking like the kind of context of the book, like merely live the poetry. I was kind of thinking, I'm sat here trying to work out what this SR is, and maybe it's just sort of like a stop analysing and just live in it kind of red herring type of thing.
I had the same question, and I wondered if it was just like, sir, are we talking about class? I mean, Phillips talks about class in the essay, and Bill Toge is a sort of subversion of the Victorian upper class, because it's the most everyday blokish kind of name that you can get, which I thought was quite nice. That's as far as I got with that SR.
I think on one level, it's certainly like perhaps a cheeky joke about the power that poets yield in constructing meaning from individual elements, such as letters strung together in a certain way.
Which are just sounds.
Exactly. Ultimately. Especially in the context of this instruction towards trying to understand and also trying to live. How can one live? SR is kind of a nonsensical instruction. But I also think that those letters, of course, are found in the word verse as well. So this idea of breaking up, breaking verse apart, stitching it back together, reconfiguring it, might be a way to live the poetry as well. And of course, with a page such as this, it really forces the reader to confront the actual experience of reading. Do I make the choice to move in a conventional fashion, reading in a certain way? Do I jump across the page where the rivers of text are taking me? How do I deal with these isolated moments that have kind of fallen behind? How do I read? And so I think that choice and that agency and that power is granted over to the reader. And so the reader becomes a poet in that sense, fashioning meaning from the fragments on the page. So I think it's a page of transition. And I think it's also kind of a, much like Tom, it's a little wink. A knowing wink, I think.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, I because occasionally I would think to myself, am I getting this wrong? Am I reading this incorrectly? And am I missing something here? But the whole tone of it, the whole visuals of it just suggest it's an invite.
Yeah.
There is no kind of wrong or absolute right to it. Yeah.
I also think just with this image, like, do they look like words to you on the background as well?
They do, sort of squibbles. Squibbles? Just made up a new word there. Squibbles. But it's, it, again, it's maybe, it feels as though, well, they're not letters, right? We can't really see coherence there.
And then in my edition, the line that stands out most to me of the palimpsest of Malick's text in the in the top section is, do you see my meaning? So there's this ghostly question and resurrection almost as well. So there's this layer of three different types of words all interrupting each other, all inviting each other. And we give authority to the SR when this question of do you see my meaning is left buried as well. So there's all these dynamics pertaining to power, agency, voice, interruption, invitation, as you said, all kind of working together.
I also love the fact, I'm glad that you highlighted the original page, because right at the top there, there's that line, poets are to men as human beings. So already we can kind of clearly see how a poetry has been dug out of the original, that word poetry and poetry in both of them. Wonderful, wonderful process.
Yeah.
All right, I think that is all we have time for today. So a human is both simple and complicated to find. You'll find numerous editions online, particularly of the 2012 fifth edition, which is the one that I've been referring to. But a final edition, which Izzy and Chloe have been reading, came out earlier this year, 2023. Both published by Thames and Hudson and reasonably priced and easy to find online or through your local bookshop or library. There's also a huge range of excerpts available on individual pages to buy via tomphillips.co.uk, where you can also listen to Phillips reading his work. There's also an app to download on Apple and Android. For those based in London, the British Library also holds numerous editions, all of which are a lot of fun to explore. I do recommend that if anyone is close to the British Library, then they do so. Chloe, you are going to receive your Radical Writing flag in a future episode, so you're going to have to wait for that. But Izzy, I can now present you with your Radical Writing flag.
Yay,
congratulations. And thank you so much, both of you, for coming on. It's been a real, real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So you have been listening to the Radical Writing Podcast. Huge thank you to my guests, Chloe Pinto and Izzy Snowden. And equally huge thank you to our production team, Alistair Robinson, Mark Dutton and Rob Adie. Join us next time for episode 5, where we'll be discussing Russell Hoban's Ridley Walker. And as always, stay radical.